Culver against the Commonwealth. Mr. Williams, Mr. Katz. Okay, Mr. Williams, how are you today? All right, you have 50 minutes. Would you like to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
All right. We'll be glad to hear from you when you're ready to go.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Travis Williams. I represent Cornelius Oliver in the matter today for appeal. Your Honor, this is essentially the case of the wide term. We brought forward two arguments first.
All right, let me stop you before we get too far down this road. This whole case has been presented as a traffic stop case. Am I incorrect, as I read the record, that certainly the officer pursued your client, but he never actually made a traffic stop? By the time he got to the point where he had stopped his police car, the defendant in this case had already arrived at his destination, and I think the record reflects he was out of his car and standing, I think, on his own property, getting ready to head into his house. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that is correct.
If that's the case, why do we have a traffic stop at all, and why aren't we analyzing this from the standpoint of whether reasonable suspicion was established at some point after that, I guess, what might be at least argued as a consensual encounter in his front sidewalk or lawn or wherever it was, and then once the odor of alcohol and other things became apparent, we have a reasonable suspicion, either existing or not existing at that point in time. Why do we care about anything that happened prior to the officer arriving at your client's residence?
Because our view is different, that the stop occurred when the defendant was not free to leave or, in his essence, going to his own house. The officer prevented
him. So, counsel, your position is that the stop was when the officer approached him in the driveway?
Yes, ma'am.
And how is that a stop?
Because the defendant was not free to either get back in his vehicle and leave or to go into his home and resume his normal duties once he got home.
Well, it's not a stop when the officer approaches him. Would you agree with that? In other words, if the officer pulls up in front of my house and I happen to be standing in my front yard or in my driveway, and a police car pulls up and the officer gets out and walks up to me, and that's not a detention at that point, is it? It's not until something occurs that a reasonable person would conclude that they're not free to go about their business. Isn't that the law?
That's the law.
So in other words, if the officer, again, getting back to my hypothetical, if I'm standing in my driveway and an officer comes up to me and starts engaging me in conversation, that's not a Terry stop at that point. But once he starts asking me to do field sobriety tests or demands to see some identification or something along those lines, we might have a different situation at that point, correct?
Correct.
Now, if I understand this record correctly, certainly at the point when the officer approached your client in his driveway, he could detect an odor of alcohol at that point, correct?
That's correct.
And he had just observed, or he's certainly aware that your client had just been behind the wheel of a car because he followed the car to the residence. So why isn't the mere odor of alcohol at that point, even if at convert the consensual encounter into a Terry stop, but one based upon reasonable suspicion?
Because the reasonable suspicion existed prior to the officer's approach.
But why do we care? Why do we care about wide turns or speed limits or anything if the officer had a perfectly valid constitutional right to approach your client in his driveway and engage him in conversation as a consensual encounter?
Well, it may not be as important for the motion to suppress as it is for the case on the merits.
Well, was any of this argued below? Did the Commonwealth ever argue this was a consensual encounter of any kind?
No, the Commonwealth did not make that argument.
It looked to me like the Commonwealth conceded that this was a detention.
That's correct.
Okay. So let me focus on the detention itself. It's 3:42 in the morning. A police officer with his lights flashing says he observes your client at an excessive rate of speed accelerate through a turn, cross three lanes of traffic all the way from the far left to the far right without signaling. Why isn't that sufficient for the officer to say, this guy might be drunk? I need to investigate.
Because you have to break it down into parts. The first
no, part, it's just a totality of the circumstances analysis. We don't,
that's correct.
We don't parse the parts.
Well, I think to reach the totality of circumstances, you have to look at the parts. And in this particular case, the officer opines that he accelerates at a high rate of speed of 45 to 50 miles per hour in a 45 mile per hour zone, which is not excessive as compared to the speed that's been established by the Department of Transportation. Second, the excessive acceleration, the defendant is at a dead standstill at a traffic light, so he has to accelerate to go from 0 to 45 miles per hour.
I think you're missing something, though. If you go back to the original Terry case,
yes,
none of those folks in Terry were doing anything that was wrong, anything illegal.
That's correct.
So it's 3 o'clock in the morning. They're standing in a commercial area. Nobody, you know, there's no other traffic. Police officer suspicious because it's a commercial area. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. They're standing outside of a jewelry store, peering in the windows. And the question was whether it was reasonable to suspect that there might be criminal activity afoot. Isn't that what we have here if we're going to go down this road with the traffic stop? The officer testified that he's got another motorist stopped. This car comes out of nowhere, cuts across 3 lanes of traffic, and while he may not have been speeding for all we know, he was certainly going fast enough that the officer testified that he was afraid for his own safety because, you know, in his own experience, people slow down when they see a police car pull by the side of the road because they don't want to be next. And so the officer pursued the individual to investigate, to find out what was going on. I mean, I don't think he necessarily suspected DUI at that point, but he was. I think the record suggests he was concerned about why this guy went by him so fast, and he wanted to basically ask that question. And, you know, so assuming we're going to rule on the legality of the stop at all, if we're going to get there, then why isn't it reasonable for the officer to want to ask that very question under these circumstances?
I think it's reasonable. However, it's not reasonable to assume that the person may be intoxicated or impaired.
Well, that's... He doesn't have to have evidence to believe that he's intoxicated. He has to have a reasonable, articulable suspicion. Clearly, he has an articulable suspicion. The question is whether it's reasonable. And I'm just wondering at 3:42 in the morning and under similar circumstances, how many police officers would just kind of wave, have a nice day as they see a driver do something like this?
That's a very good question, and I don't know that many would. However, I don't
Well, doesn't that answer then make this reasonable? If most police officers would do the same thing, then why is it unreasonable for this police officer to do it here?
I think it's unreasonable to assume that the person is impaired just because it's 3:42 a.m. in the morning and passes him with the officer believes, I guess, at his rate of speed is too close.
Well, counsel, it doesn't matter what offense the officer, I mean, it's an objective standard, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So it could just as easily have been the officer that the facts support reckless.
Yes,
ma'am. That the driver was driving recklessly. It doesn't have to be that the driver was a DUI. Correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, clearly at that point he had no idea whether this guy had been drinking or not. I mean,
yes, sir.
You know, all he knows is his car is going by him, cutting across 3 lanes of traffic a lot faster than people would normally do so in his own experience. That's basically what his testimony comes down to, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
And so the only question for us is, was the trial court correct in concluding that was a reasonable conclusion on his part?
I understand that. Our position still is that it was not.
Let's switch over to the merits argument a little bit so you've got a little time to address that. Here we have evidence that the defendant didn't do well on a number of balance and coordination drills, plus evidence that apparently his memory was impaired because he didn't even remember or he professed not to have done certain, I don't want to use the word tests, but demonstrations.
Yes, sir.
That the officer said he did. Why isn't that enough for the court to conclude that he was under the influence?
Because the results of the tests, of course, are of the officer's standard. He has to decide that the defendant does not pass to his satisfaction. First, it's an unbalanced test. And secondly, if you look at the results, they're mixed. When the officer does numerous tests, he opines that the defendant does well on some parts and does not so well on the other parts.
Well, I think we can all agree that inebriation is a sliding scale. You know, you can be falling down drunk or you can be just slightly under the influence.
Yes, sir.
The question is, the way our statute is phrased is, we don't call it this, we call it under the influence, but basically the thrust of the crime is consuming alcohol, then getting behind the wheel of a car, and then in a situation where your reaction time is impaired. That's you know, in other words, it's not illegal to have a drink and drive. It's illegal to have a drink and drive when you're when the alcohol is influencing your driving behavior. Are you with me so far?
I'm with you.
And of course, when we have blood and breath tests, you know, it's a slam dunk. You either pass the threshold or you don't. But the nature of the crime is such is that if there's evidence of impairment, there's no issue here about drinking. Your client admitted he was drinking. We have the odor of alcohol, which nobody's contesting. So the issue is there evidence from which one could conclude that his driving was impaired? Well, we have the testimony about the limited driving that was observed by the police officer, but we also have the field sobriety test, which clearly he didn't do very well on. So if that is evidence of impairment, it seems to me you'd have to argue that somehow failing all these field sobriety tests either is not evidence of impairment or, in the alternative, can't be used as evidence of impairment for some legal reason that I'm not aware of. Because arguably, the failure of those tests alone supports some degree of impairment. Not necessarily that he was drunker than a skunk, if you will, or falling down drunk, or, you know, three sheets to the wind, but clearly impaired to the point where his reactions or his ability to deal with operating a motor vehicle on the highway of the Commonwealth was to some degree or other impaired. How do you respond?
I respond that we have a mixed result from the field test, and we can't conclude that they're complete failures.
But these aren't tests. I mean, this is not an SAT. Yeah, this is not an SAT test where you score it. The Supreme Court has adopted the definition of intoxicated found in 4.1-100 for purposes of the DUI statute, and it means a person has drunk enough alcoholic beverages to observably affect his manner, disposition, speech, muscular movement, general appearance, or behavior. And here the police officer described a number of instances where the alcoholic beverages that he observed or smelled anyway affected his manner, disposition, speech, and muscular movement. So why isn't the court accepted that? Now, the court didn't accept the pass-fail mark that the officer gave, but the court was able to hear from the officer. He obviously had some balance problems, some coordination problems, some problems understanding instructions, and some problems in memory. All of the factors that define an intoxicated person.
Well, again, I think that the court can certainly conclude that, but when you look at the results, and we're still subjected to the officer's reporting of those results, whereas the officer on the 9-step walk and turn, there was no allegation that the defendant did not count out 9 steps, that he did not walk heel to toe, that he did not pivot on step 9, but the officer says he felt like he dragged his foot while he walked.
Counsel, I just wanted, you're almost through your rebuttal time as well. So
yes, sir.
Go ahead and finish answering the question.
And then he also concluded that on the one-legged stand, the defendant never lost count when he's counting to 30. He put his foot down 4 times, but he resumed. So part of the test, one, to see whether or not the person can concentrate and count, he does well. The finger dexterity test, he does well 2 out of the 3 times. So when you look at the totality of all those tests, he didn't perform to complete satisfaction, but he didn't fail miserably. I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Katz?
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
May it please the Court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Well, let me just start you off with what, you know, I know the Commonwealth didn't raise it, but when I read this record, the first thing that jumped off the page at me was, why are we even talking, why do we even care about all this stuff that happened before the officer approached him in his driveway? What's your response to that?
Certainly, and I suppose if this court were satisfied that it was a consensual encounter, that if the court is not concerned with the earlier stop, notwithstanding the Commonwealth's position at trial, then I suppose the position this court would be in would be that the trial court was right for the wrong reason, that it reached.
I wouldn't go that far. I think the question is where did the seizure take place?
Sure. Now,
there's no question there's a seizure here, and the seizure needs to be supported by either probable cause or reasonable suspicion. But it seems to me analytically we're not necessarily bound by any concession the Commonwealth made if the record clearly supports a different conclusion. And as I say, if there's no seizure except after he's out of his car at his destination, I simply wonder why we would need, as a matter of law, to address anything that occurred prior to when he was seized.
And I think that analysis would be driven by the findings of fact that this court would give deference to. And I believe there was a tension between the testimony of the defendant as to when he was intercepted by the officer, where in relation to his car, versus what the officer's testimony was. Clearly, the officer's testimony was credited by the trial court, and that would be given deference here in this court. And so in light of that testimony, I think the record is clear that the encounter happens long after he's left the car.
Well, clearly the officer thought he'd stopped him. I mean, but the officer's not lawyers. They're not lawyers or judges. And clearly he thought this was a traffic stop. But analytically, you know, the point is, at what point was this individual not free to leave? And it seems to me any officer can walk up to any person, certainly standing in their driveway, and approach it as a consensual encounter until something occurs. And in this case, almost immediately, he detects the odor of alcohol.
I think the exact answer to Your Honor's question would be at page 40 of the joint appendix, at which point the officer asks him to produce his license and registration. If that's the point in time that the court is inquiring about, that is the point in time at which the seizure actually occurs as a legal matter. And as Your Honor,
he'd already detected the odor of alcohol at that point, hadn't he?
That is correct. And he also noticed he was unsteady on his feet at that time. And so,
but it didn't. I mean, the officer had his lights, his blue lights on when he pulled up at the defendant's house. Would a reasonable person at that point feel free to just turn around and keep walking?
Well, and it is for that reason that the Commonwealth on Appeal fully addressed all the issues inherent in the stop. I think if the court is satisfied that the seizure does not occur until the point in time at which his license is asked, that would obviously be my answer. But if the court feels necessary to engage in the analysis supporting the stop, I'm more than happy to address that. As I pointed out in brief, there are three independent bases upon which the stop was a valid stop. I'm happy to address those in greater detail.
Well, does the officer need to articulate exactly what offense he suspects may have been committed?
No, Your Honor. In fact, it merely must be, could an objective officer, under the circumstances presented, reasonably suspect someone of wrongdoing? And clearly that's met here.
And the purpose of the stop is to determine what that wrongdoing might be.
And I would suggest that Terry and its progeny fully expect that innocent people will be caught up under the standard that governs. I mean, it could perfectly turn out that no wrongdoing was happening at all. It must merely be supported reasonably, and I would argue that it was here. We have the officer's testimony that it was almost vertical, that it wasn't a straight line towards his position, but more of a diagonal swerve, and of course the testimony that he felt unsafe exposed on the shoulder of the road after dealing with the other traffic stop. Clearly, that would lead an objective person to reasonably suspect reckless driving, that a person was not cognizant of the potential consequences of an accident, that he was indifferent to the harm posed to others by the driving manifestations. With respect to the lane change,
I will tell you one thing about this that troubles me. The lane change, which I think the officer at least relied upon primarily for the stop because he had the signal lane change. And the statute doesn't require signaling unless other vehicles would be affected. There's nothing in this record that suggests there's any other vehicles on the highway. So I'm not, you know, I guess what troubled me mildly about this, to the extent anything did, quite honestly, is the notion of what might be considered purely legal activity. In other words, the failure to signal a lane change would not necessarily support the sort of Wren type stop, which I realize is a probable cause determination. Do I understand now, at least from your argument, that you're not relying on any sort of a Wren analysis for supporting the stop here?
Well, I would like to respond, Your Honor. And I think the officer's quote, and this is at page 18 of the joint appendix, was, other than where I was at, I don't feel that he endangered anybody else or anybody proceeding through the intersection. And I would argue that the inference to be drawn from that testimony when viewed in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth was that there were, in fact, other vehicles proceeding through the intersection.
I'm not sure how you get there from here. But.
Well, the fact that he said that he didn't endanger anybody proceeding through the intersection, I think if there was nobody proceeding through the intersection, he would have said there was nobody through the intersection at the time. But the fact that he mentions that he didn't endanger anybody proceeding through the intersection would suggest logically that there were, in fact, other cars going through. Well, I think we have to view the testimony.
I'm sure I would agree with your argument. Okay, I get it.
But this is not necessarily a failure to signal issue. I mean, if you want to parse statutes, which I've said earlier, I don't really think is appropriate in these cases, but 46.2846 says that when you make a left-hand turn, you should end up in the left lane lawfully available to traffic moving in such direction upon the highway being entered, as nearly as practical in the left lane lawfully available to traffic. So if you want to parse statutes, he should have made a left turn, ended up in the left lane, and then proceeded to change lanes over to the right.
Well, as I said, I think there are three independent bases. We could rely on 46.2846 concerning how one makes left turns. I would argue with respect to the failure to signal, it doesn't have to affect other vehicles. It merely may affect them. So whether it did or not, if an objective officer could reasonably believe that that driving may have affected another driver, then it would be appropriate to stop.
Well, certainly if he'd said all that, I'd be with you. But it seems that you're reaching, quite honestly, I think, to try to get out of what the officer actually said, that sort of reasonably supports the notion that there's other cars around at 3:42 in the morning. So.
I respect your honor's position, but I would simply argue, viewing this record in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the language employed by the officer was not there were no other cars in the intersection. It didn't affect anybody else proceeding through the intersection. And I think I'm entitled to that inference. I understand.
And it's an objective standard, correct?
It
doesn't really matter what the officer himself believed.
And I would just circle back to know that would be a necessary part of the analysis if we had a consensual encounter in his driveway.
Certainly. Well, I think, in fairness, the other two bases are ample. Even if we get there, we've got the reckless driving, we've got the failure to end up where he was. But if I could turn to the merits, as Your Honor pointed out, 4.1100 stands as a legislative enactment that reasonable people know when an individual is inebriated. We don't need an expert to tell us that. And I understood the argument on appeal was that the Commonwealth's evidence failed to provide some expert testimony concerning what the tests mean or what a sober person would do on the test. And I would argue none of that is necessary. This isn't like a narcotics intoxication where you need an expert to say how the narcotics would act on a person, what you would reasonably expect to be the result of that intoxication derived by the narcotics. Reasonable people know when someone is inebriated. The legislature has recognize that with the statute, and the field sobriety demonstrations, to use Your Honor's word, provided an opportunity to view that in context. We have an admission of drinking. We have an admission of drinking within a relative short time span prior to the encounter, and we have the manifestations that were observed by the officer. And in the absence of those things, perhaps expert testimony would be necessary. If there was nothing to say, well, what you're seeing is related to consumption of alcohol, then that would be certainly different.
Well, we have the odor of alcohol, so and an admission that he had at least several drinks.
So I would argue under these facts, there is ample evidence supporting the driving.
And then, one of the factors that I don't think has been discussed is he denied having performed one or two, I can't recall which, of these demonstrations that the officer said he did. Now, the trial court can either say, well, that's attributable to one of two things. Either you're too drunk to remember, in which it's an adverse inference against you, or that you're lying, and the reason you're lying is an attempt to conceal your guilt, which is an adverse inference against him.
And I would argue we do have a clear rejection in this record of the defendant's testimony. And further, I would note there's an argument on brief suggesting hypotheses of innocence for why the field sobriety performances were as they demonstrated themselves to be. And I would argue that those hypotheses of innocence were not developed at trial. The notion that he was nervous or that his contact lenses caused him to be disoriented, none of that was presented to the trial court, and I would argue it was inappropriate to raise now. With that, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Katz. Appreciate your argument. All right, Mr. Williams, you have a little over a minute left, I think.
But I will wait.
All right. In that case, we'll come down to Greek Council and then take up Shelton versus Trump.